Boer roots. A dramatic shift took place in the battle to recover the life and order of the New Testament Church in England during the 1590s and onwards. Since the conforming Puritans had largely given up the fight, in the main it was left to the despised and persecuted separatists to carry it on. It was they who now took up the weapons against the established church as the Puritans were dropping them. The vestment controversy had worn itself out. The old leaders of it were dead or had conformed. Thus, the conforming Puritans drew back from the struggle, leaving the field to be occupied by the separatists. As I've explained, those Puritans who conformed devoted themselves to preaching, and they did it very effectively. But the fact is, they gave up the struggle to obtain a truly reformed church. The separatists did not. Now, although they were sneered at, and their names have been almost lost in obscurity or suffered through grievous neglect, it must not be thought that the separatist preachers were ineffective, powerless, or intellectually weak. That would be to make a terrible mistake and do a gross injustice to them. Nor did they neglect their writing while they engaged in the struggle to get the church back to the New Testament. The truth is, there were spiritual giants among them. And when comparisons are made with the conforming Puritans, as they inevitably are, it must be borne in mind that the separatists had to do their works while suffering under the terrors of persecution and the privations of exile. They were not favoured cloistered fellows at Cambridge, or chaplains to various Puritan landowners, with all the advantages of relative ease, free access to a study whose walls were weighed down with book-lined shelves. Experience was rounded off with the congenial living which those positions entailed. It has been justly said, not only were the separatists logical, but their action required far more courage than the mere conforming Puritans. Not only did the act itself call for a higher degree of intellectual daring, but the penalties attached to it were greater. In many cases, conformity, so far from entailing loss or suffering, possessed a distinct monetary and social value. But no highly paid cure or easy berth in the household of a Puritan nobleman awaited the separatist. Misguided as many of the latter may have been, and disappointing as were many of the separatist movements, it would seem that, on the whole, the separatists possessed more sincerity and loyalty to their ideas than the Puritans who remained within the church. This, the great majority of them, that is, the Puritans, did. Just a word or two on the highly paid cure or easy berth for the Puritans. Their congregations within the Church of England usually increased the salaries of their ministers beyond the usual rate, to as much as 2 or 3 times. Thus the conforming Puritans drew their Church of England wages, plus the extra from their own congregations, while denouncing, or at least disagreeing violently with, the state church whose ministers they were. For this reason, it can be fairly said, here at any rate was a very tangible reward for those who felt they could remain in an institution which they condemned, while they drew pay from both sides. Many a poor parish priest must have wondered whether it were not worldly wise to turn Puritan, and a separatist had to console himself with a logical position and a comfortable conscience. Elizabeth, for all her outward stubbornness, had been inwardly affected by the hangings of the separatist leaders, Penry, Barrow, and Greenwood. The Queen had overstepped the mark, and she knew it. She was shaken, forced to recognize that the separatists and Anabaptists could be as resolute as she. They were not going to be broken. No, neither by torture nor by prison. Therefore, Elizabeth changed tack and opted for expulsion. Discharging many from the jails, she banished them from England by an act designed to retain the Queen's Majesty's servants in due obedience. This enforced exile from all the Queen's Majesty's dominions was to be forever. The Conventicle Act of 1593 made it illegal for any person above the age of 16 to refuse to attend the parish church or to go to a conventicle, that is, a separatist meeting. Imprisonment was the automatic punishment for one offence. 3 months' nonconformity meant banishment from the realm. Any further offence would lead to death by hanging. The measures adopted in the Act of 1593 had staggering consequences, far beyond the Queen's intention or comprehension. So much so, it has been asserted that no event has had greater influence on the government of the world and the success of the Christian religion than the transplantation of Englishmen, which then commenced. What Elizabeth intended to do, and no doubt thought she had done, was to secure her dominions for all time to come from being troubled by separatists. But absolutism in a state is as short-sighted as intolerance in a church, and in the Tudor Queen absolutism and intolerance were combined. What therefore she did do was to plant nurseries of freedom, destined at a future period to be fatal to the very principles of political and ecclesiastical government whose permanency she had thought to secure. It will be recalled that John Penry, just before his death, had urged the separatist ancient church to emigrate and to take special care of the widows and orphans in their flight. Most of the church followed his counsel, so that by the end of 1593 it was in two portions, with the larger in Amsterdam and the smaller in London. Yet they continued to regard themselves as one church in two parts, despite 100 miles of salt water in between. The ancient church, formed in 1592, had appointed Francis Johnson as its pastor and John Greenwood its teacher. But by the end of 1593, Greenwood was dead, hanged for his faith, and the church was in these two parts. After a while, the church elected Henry Ainsworth as its teacher in Amsterdam, but naturally, the pastor could only be in one place at a time. While Francis Johnson was in London, for most of the time he was in prison. Thus, that portion of the church which was in Amsterdam had no pastoral care, and so, according to their views, as expressed by Henry Barrow, they could not have the Lord's Supper or baptize, since they felt only the pastor could administer the ordinances. This was surely a mistake. It shows that the separatists still had ill-formed opinions of church government and the nature of a church, especially with regard to the man they called the pastor. Yet this is hardly surprising, since they were breaking new ground after 1,200 years of popery and 60 years of Church of England dominance of religious affairs. Or, to be more accurate, since the separatists were trying to get back to the New Testament. While it is true that they were muddled in their views, we must not forget the yokel who was asked the way to a certain town. "If I was going there, I wouldn't start from here," was his less than helpful reply. The separatists were making mistakes on the way, yes, but at least they were going in the right direction. And to be fair, although the separatists at the end of the 16th century were confused over the pastor issue, they were not alone. Whenever Puritans overemphasized their pastors, they were in the wrong too. And of course the Anglicans went the whole hog and called them priests. That said, it has to be faced that there was a serious error involved in this attitude towards the pastor and his relationship to the church. We are not yet free of it. Like the poor, it will always be with us, it seems. It not only survives, it is very much alive and kicking. Some Christians, many, have wrong views of the subject. What is more, these views stem from the same source as did the notions of the early separatists, namely a misplaced emphasis on a man. This stress upon the pastor is misplaced because, according to the New Testament, the church is more important than a pastor. The church exists before a pastor. The church can exist without a pastor. The church can and must discipline a pastor if necessary. In other words, the church can and must carry out its proper privileges, including the ordinances of Christ, with or without the pastor, if need be. The stark truth is, in many of today's churches, the pastor has been given an importance which is foreign to the New Testament. For example, what were the names of the pastors of the churches of the New Testament? Nobody knows. They have not been recorded. Paul did not write to them. He wrote to the saints, the church members at Rome, Ephesus, and the rest. When he did write to the bishops and deacons, he did not address them by name. Is this important? Well, things are very different today, glaringly so. Very, very frequently, almost invariably, Christians refer not to the church in any given place, but to the pastor. Pastor so-and-so's church is there. He's a good man, they say. It's wrong to do it. Nobody ever spoke in this way in the New Testament. Why should we? It is not Pastor so-and-so's church, is it? It is Christ's church. It might be justly pointed out that I have frequently written about pastors in this book. Why have I done so? Well, I have tried to write in a scriptural way, but when dealing with historical events and the historical use of words, I have been forced to keep to the terms used by the people involved. My own preference would have been to use New Testament terms, and only New Testament terms throughout, elder, bishop, pastor and teacher, overseer, and so on, treating them as the New Testament does, as one and the same, all equal. But sadly, it's not been possible. Too many believers during the years I have read about hankered after prelacy. Even today, there is a liking for hierarchy among many nonconformists. It is a desire which is very deep-seated. I realize that my words will anger some, but I am convinced they need to be said, and I deplore the need to say it. I know that even to mention the issue will offend many. Barrow, you will recall, gave himself away to the prison authorities by expressing his views on the matter. And so hateful was the notion of the equality of elders that during the time of Laud, as will be made clear in due course, John Bastwick was sent to prison for writing in defense of the principle. Indeed, there is something even more fundamentally wrong with calling a man the pastor. Why, nowhere in the New Testament is any man called a pastor. Certainly no man is ever addressed as the pastor. Furthermore, the New Testament always speaks of each church having several elders, never one pastor. Nor does it know anything of a scheme which is becoming common today, that of having several elders, with one of them being singled out as the pastor. As I've just pointed out, all elders are pastors, if the word is allowed at all. I recognize that not all elders can be or should be separated to the ministry and so receive financial support, but it is wrong to distinguish one man by coining a title for him. To do so means that these churches have invented for themselves a third order of minister, whereas the New Testament knows of only two, bishops or elders, and deacons. What is more, the word pastors appears only once in Ephesians 4:11, in the phrase pastors and teachers, and most commentators take this to refer to one office, speaking of one and the same man, the pastor-teacher. In other words, pastor never appears in the New Testament as a word in its own right, certainly never as a title. This may surprise some, so ingrained is the use of the sobriquet. To cap it all, the New Testament knows nothing whatsoever of titles. Indeed, Christ directly forbids the practice. Why, therefore, is it the almost universal custom today? Why? You see, I've not been splitting hairs. The creation of titles and their use in the church leads to a direct contradiction of the command of Christ and the setting up of a third order of minister, something in itself which is entirely unscriptural and totally unwarranted, and is yet another subtle way of introducing or maintaining hierarchy in the churches. Why can we not get back to the proper use of scriptural words? Why do so many disobey Christ? Prelacy has been brought into nonconformist churches by the back door. In the case of the ancient church, surely it should have been possible to have the Lord's Supper without the presence of Francis Johnson. If not, we've gone full circle and established a kind of separatist popery. Allowing the term for the sake of argument, can a church not baptize without a pastor? Can it not recognize an elder when it has none? Think of the logical consequences if this last point is not granted. It must be possible for a church without an elder to recognize such a man, otherwise it is condemned to remain in that unscriptural condition forever. Why then can a church carry out some aspects of its life without a pastor and not others? In any event, as I've observed, part of the trouble in the ancient church was a reliance upon a single pastor, whereas the New Testament always speaks of a plurality of elders in each church. This scriptural reform would have removed entirely this particular difficulty for the ancient church. All these points merit further development, but I must keep the book within bounds. I have developed the argument fully in my book, The Pastor, Does He Exist? I wish to say, however, that I do not want to give the impression that I have little regard for Christ's gifts to his church, pastor teachers among them, certainly not. But neither do I want to make popes of them. It has been done times without number. Has been. It can be so today. Can be. It is. Here are two up-to-date examples of how frightening this unacceptable emphasis upon the pastor can be. The first concerns a Reformed Baptist church where the pastor was away, and the service was to be taken by a deacon, a man who looks upon the pastor in the way I have deplored. This deacon was approached on the way into the meeting by a stranger who asked if there was a service there that evening. The deacon replied to the effect, no, since the pastor was not present, upon which the stranger walked off. What a catastrophe that might turn out to be, on the basis that without the pastor the church could not possibly hold a proper meeting. In what spiritual state was the stranger? Was he seeking after salvation? Was he turned away not only from the meeting, but from what? Who knows? The second example concerns a letter printed in the Evangelical Times, October 1994, printed with the obvious approval of the editor. The letter, from a sin-sick soul, was a virtual confession of sin to the pastor, with the urgent request that the pastor should pray for this sin-sick soul. The writer could not even address the pastor by his name. The letter and what it represented boiled down to unadulterated priestcraft. Confession of sin to the pastor? Desire for the pastor to pray? Could the man or the woman not pray for themselves? Christ was not mentioned even once. And the man knew what was wrong in his life, but instead of putting it right, he shuffled his responsibility onto God and the pastor. The letter and its publication was an offence to all those who reject popery, or it ought to have been. So this is what the pastor business comes to. Pastor and priest are not so very different in spelling, and when men and women hold the kind of views revealed in that letter, pastor and priest are virtually the same in more ways than mere spelling. Milton was right, was he not? Presbyter can be priest, merely writ large. As Charles Hodge said, the people should not place their confidence in ministers who belong to the church, and not the church to them. Quite right. There is a further point to be made, however. Even though the ancient church was too scrupulous over the conduct of the Lord's Supper with respect to the absence of their pastor, what a contrast to the unthinking attitude of many today. Many Christians take the Lord's Supper here, there, and everywhere, or nowhere, with little or no discipline, or hardly a thought of it. Many churches are very lax about the ordinance. The early Separatists were too finicky, it must be said. But how much more worthy of Christ and the New Testament than today's flabby attitude? To return to the history. After about 4 years of enforced separation, the pastor, elders, and deacons of the ancient church eventually managed to get to Amsterdam and settle there, thus leaving the small London portion of the church devoid of all pastoral care. This London rump made no attempt at separate organization, and the last to be heard of it was in 1624, totally without resident officers. By this enforced emigration, the battle for the church moved to Amsterdam at the end of the 16th century, where, it is true, the separatists were out of prison and free to worship God. But they were exiled, in extreme poverty, and, to state the obvious, among a people who spoke a foreign language, altogether a daunting prospect. They took up what manual trades they could find, even though these only paid a pittance of about sixpence a week. If it had not been for the legacy of Henry Barrow, along with the kindness of the Dutch magistrates and some Puritans who were settled abroad, they would have perished by starvation. Henry Ainsworth, at first, was a porter to a bookseller, but as I've said, he soon became the teacher of the church. He was so poor, he was forced to live on boiled roots. Ainsworth, a remarkable man, modest, retiring, and amiable, was born in 1570 in Swanton, Norfolk, and died at the age of 52 after a long and painful illness. Of a delicate constitution, his life was cut short by endless quarrels caused by others, and by his own ceaseless labours and severe trials, some of which will feature in this account. In his youth, he entered Caius at Cambridge, but it's possible that he did not complete his university education, for some reason we cannot discover. It was said that he scarce set foot within a college walls, yet he was reckoned to be one of the best Greek and Hebrew scholars of his day throughout Europe, being commonly known as that renowned Hebraist. He was acclaimed as mighty in the scriptures. Indeed, he was noted for his outstanding preaching ability, being a profound and moving teacher. He showed a thorough acquaintance with scripture, to the extent of being able to quote the exact words of a text without any reference to the book. He was also a prolific writer, publishing works in Latin in addition to English, 23 volumes altogether, among which were versions of the Psalms, a collection of annotations on various parts of scripture, including the entire Pentateuch, besides some attempts at sacred song. He was no slouch. The ancient church met with other difficulties in Holland, in addition to their poverty and the problems of a foreign language. The Dutch and French pastors in the Low Countries were very suspicious of this group of refugee separatists who had the audacity to set themselves against the Church of England and the Puritans. Most of them were obviously unlearned, working class, and poor, and yet they claimed to have the truth, and only they. Impertinence of a high order. The church was well aware of its difficulty, so to clear up any misunderstanding, in 1596 it published a true confession of the faith. The preface opened out all the cruelties and wrongs they had suffered in England at the hands of the prelates, and it's obvious that they felt themselves bitterly misused. As we have seen, they certainly had been. They rightly complained that their enemies had treated them with barbarous cruelty, and would not answer them in free writing and conference, but as savage beasts rending and tearing us with their teeth, greedily hunting after Christ's poor lambs, misusing their bodies with all exquisite tyranny in long and lamentable imprisonment. The confession went on to develop 45 articles to explain the doctrine, order, and practice of the ancient church. It was purely Calvinistic in its view of salvation. On the burning issue of the status of the Church of England, the writers were blunt and dogmatic. Reformation is essential. The state church is corrupt, and the people of God must leave it, they declared. On the ministry, they believe that it is a matter for each particular church, and only that church, to sort out. And they held that the minister depends on that church's recognition and appointment for his authority. But at this stage they were still grievously muddled over the place and power of the magistrate, for they expected the magistrates to put a stop to corrupt ministry and worship, saying that princes and magistrates were duty-bound to suppress and root out by their authority all false ministries, voluntary religions, and counterfeit worship of God, yea, to enforce all their subjects, whether ecclesiastical or civil, to do their duties to God and men. These were amazing words from men who themselves had suffered so much under this totally unscriptural view. It shows how ingrained Constantine thinking has become in the minds of men. As it clear, they mistakenly did not confine the magistrates' duties to the civil realm as the New Testament does. Though they had been dealt with by intolerance in their spiritual affairs, they wished to deal with others in exactly the same way. Religion is nothing if it is not voluntary, yet the ancient church wanted the magistrate to enforce a voluntary religion. It can hardly be credited. Alas, they were not alone in continuing with this evil. What of the pastor of the ancient church, Francis Johnson, meanwhile? What do we know of him? He had not always been a separatist, so how did he become one? What were his abilities and qualities? William Bradford, later governor in New England, gave him high praise when he said that he was a very grave man, and an able teacher, and was the most solemn in all his administrations that we have seen any. This fine testimony must not be forgotten when we come to look at the catalogue of Johnson's later failures and his dismal end. Johnson was born in Richmond, Yorkshire, in 1562. Graduating at Cambridge, he became a fellow and was at that time a staunch Presbyterian. What is more, there is evidence that in his heart he was never anything different. Never one to fight shy of conflict, on the 6th of January 1588, he preached at St. Mary's, Cambridge, on 1 Peter 5, 1-4, when he insisted on the Presbyterian system. For this he was imprisoned, and then expelled from the university, retracing the footsteps of Cartwright, who had gone ahead about 15 years before. He became a comfortably well-off minister in Middleburg among the English merchants there. In 1591, he came across a newly printed batch of copies of a book by the separatists, Barrow and Greenwood, and being exceedingly mad against them, persuaded the magistrates to confiscate and burn the entire consignment. Standing by to oversee the bonfire, he saved 2 copies in order that he might read the offensive material for himself, refute it, and then publish his findings. Interestingly, he knew the separatist book was wrong, and had it burned even though he had not read it. But as he read the book, he was quite overcome by the arguments of Barrow and Greenwood. It's pleasing to be able to report that 14 years later, to make amends, he republished the work entirely at his own expense. Having been persuaded, he did not stifle his conscience nor cling to his easy lifestyle, but threw in his lot with the separatists, and thereby brought upon himself poverty, imprisonment, and suffering. He gave up his prosperous Presbyterian position, returned to London at once, and sought out Barrow, who was then in the Fleet prison. Thus he joined the group of separatists in London, and became its pastor when the church was formed in 1592. He narrowly escaped the fate of hanging suffered by Barrow, Greenwood, and Penry, but nevertheless he was locked in the clink for 5 miserable years. George, his brother, was detained at the same time in the Fleet, while the elder of the ancient church, Daniel Studley, was held in Newgate. As a consequence of Elizabeth's measures to clear the jails, Johnson, his brother, Studley, and another stiff-necked separatist were eventually released upon condition that they sailed for an island in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. They duly set sail with some merchant adventurers and a convoy of 2 vessels on the 8th of April, 1597. When one of the ships foundered upon rocks, the other rescued all hands and then returned to England. The separatists were now in an impossible position, since death by hanging awaited any who broke the rules of banishment. Accordingly, they hid in London, and then escaped to Amsterdam in September 1597, where they were at last reunited with the church. In spite of all the difficulties caused by their poverty, the misunderstanding by the Dutch and French, a foreign language to cope with, and the absence of their pastor for such a long time, the ancient church flourished exceedingly in Amsterdam. So much so, by the turn of the century, it had 300 members, now under the combined care of Francis Johnson and Henry Ainsworth, men of the highest spiritual and mental caliber. The church also appointed 4 ruling elders, 3 deacons, and a deaconess, a widow of advanced years, who sat with a birch rod in her hand to keep the little children in great awe from disturbing the congregation, besides doing acts of kindness among the women, such as arranging sick care and poor relief where necessary. It is possible that the deaconess was required to discipline the children in the services because the church had a great many orphans to take care of. These arrangements raise a practical, interesting, and important question for us, namely the way a church deals with children. There has been much talk about this in recent years, and many innovations have been introduced to cope with children. However, not all the measures which have been adopted have been sensible, let alone scriptural, and we could learn something from days long past. For a start, in the ancient church, the children were not allowed to disturb the congregation in the service. Things have certainly changed. Nowadays, the adults must not be allowed to disturb the children. Preachers are told they must cut their sermons short to cater for them, or rather their parents, who find their children a convenient excuse. Superficial, supposedly amusing stories occupy the children's slot. Children's services and family services replace the proper worship of God. That, and worse, is frequently a feature of church services today. The ancient church knew nothing of all this. Evidently, the early separatists would not recognize the modern overemphasis upon children in worship. But what is of far greater importance, there is not the slightest justification in the New Testament for any cultivation of youthism in the church. On the other hand, the ancient church did not countenance a wholesale removal of the children from the service. It is apparent that they did not have any procedure whereby the children of believers were taken out of meetings. They knew nothing of children's church, for example. This is very different to the attitude common today. Furthermore, children who were capable of interrupting the congregation and capable of being corrected were corrected and not removed. Was that not right? There is no suggestion of anything to the contrary in the New Testament. As for the Old Testament, the children of the Israelites were present with their parents in worship, and the parents instructed their children as to the meaning, significance, and importance of what took place. Indeed, the children were deliberately exposed to the worship of God and His ordinances, with the express purpose that they could and should ask about it. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, His testimonies, and His statutes which He has commanded you, and you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, "What is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you?" then you shall say to your son, "We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe. Then He brought us out from there, that He might bring us in, to give us the land of which He swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that He might preserve us alive, as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us, if we are careful, to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God, as He has commanded us. When your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, 'What are these stones?' then you shall let your children know, saying, 'God did His mighty works among His people for many purposes, one of which was the spiritual instruction of succeeding generations of children by their parents. Concerning His dealings with Pharaoh, God said, "For I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine before him, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and your son's son the mighty things I have done in Egypt, and my signs which I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord." This instruction of the children was to be a part of the perpetual remembrance of God's dealings with his people, and one of the ways in which the fear of God would be kept alive in Israel. The little ones were not excluded. When they were settled in the land of promise, the Hebrew people had to keep the Passover strictly according to the commands of God, and this included instruction of the sons by the fathers. "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up out from Egypt.' So shall it be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What is this?' that you shall say to him, 'By the strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, and it came to pass, when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. Therefore I sacrificed to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem.'" Joshua did this at the earliest opportunity. Notice how frank and full the instruction had to be. No keeping back the difficult bits. Very often today, children are taught merely the stories and not given the principles of God's word. Very little doctrine is given to them. Timothy knew the Holy Scriptures from childhood, and that means from a very early age, certainly from infancy. The Greek word is used to speak of Christ in the manger. It is used even of John when he was in the womb of his mother. Timothy had learned and been assured of the scriptures by the teaching of his mother and grandmother from his earliest days. They did not wait until he had become a teenager. And they taught him more than memory verses, for he had learned the things, the doctrines, arguments, and principles of the scriptures. He knew the meaning of them. It goes without saying that the teaching was suited to his capacity to learn, but the capacity of children is enormous. Do not underestimate it. Ask the Jesuits. They require only a few years to indoctrinate infants in their so-called care. I ask, is the biblical training of children a common occurrence these days? If not, why not? Is it that parents are unfamiliar with God's word themselves? If so, it must be put right. Please notice Paul's reference to Timothy's teachers, knowing from whom you have learned. The quality of the things taught is vital, but so is the quality of the teacher, his or her character and lifestyle. Parents who would have their children walk in truth must walk in that truth themselves. The children must be led, not driven. They will rapidly detect any discrepancy between what is taught and what is or is not lived out, and they will do so from their earliest days. This need for a full explanation to children of God's ways and works is further brought to our attention by God's use of Joel to stir his people to carry out his ordinances in this regard. He said the children had to know the whys and wherefores of God's works, even of his judgments upon the land. Tell your children about it. Let your children tell their children, and their children another generation, was the command of God. The youngest of children were expected to figure in the sacred assemblies, including those on the solemn fast days. It is readily admitted that this is a task which needs much perseverance, grace, and understanding. But it is a great privilege for believing parents, and it is their duty. In short, and these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. These principles apply both in the public ordinances of God and in the private affairs of the home. As I said earlier, there is nothing in the New Testament to make us believe that these or similar principles do not still apply. No. There is nothing to suggest that the children of believers ought to be anything other than present in public worship, to hear the preaching, to observe the Lord's Supper, deliberately to be exposed to all of it in order that their curiosity can be aroused and their parents can explain the spiritual meaning of everything which goes on. This must be part of the way to train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old he will not depart from it. Paul wrote to children. Think of it. Paul the Apostle wrote to children. Observe the way in which he treated them, how he approached them, how he argued out scripture to them. No foolish tale spinning from the Apostle. Ephesians 6, Colossians 3. Do you think he would have tolerated children who were of an age to understand sitting before him, but colouring pictures, reading other books, or playing with toys while he preached? He had something to say to them, and they needed to give him all their attention. They were not in the service to be amused, diverted, or ignored. He did not talk down to them. How very different today in many churches. I realize the children in question were far more advanced in age than mere infants, but even so they were children, and Paul spoke directly to them. Are many adults in churches these days addressed from the pulpit as solemnly and seriously as Paul spoke to children? I doubt it. Instead of bringing children up, adults are too often brought down. What is the motive for childishness in worship? Spurgeon, preaching on Exodus 12, 21-27, in a sermon entitled The Blood of Sprinkling and the Children, came to the passage, "And it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service, that you shall say," he declared, "inquiry should be excited in the minds of our children. Oh, that we could get them to ask questions about the things of God. Some of them inquire very early. Others of them seemed diseased with much the same indifference as older folks. With both orders of mind we have to deal. It is well to explain to children the ordinance of the Lord's Supper, for this shows forth the death of Christ in symbol. I regret that children do not oftener see this ordinance. Baptism and the Lord's Supper should both be placed in view of the rising generation, that they may then ask us, "What mean ye by this?" Now the Lord's Supper is a perennial gospel sermon, and it turns mainly upon the sacrifice for sin. You may banish the doctrine of the atonement from the pulpit, but it will always live in the church through the Lord's Supper. You cannot explain that broken bread and that cup filled with the fruit of the vine without reference to our Lord's atoning death. You cannot explain the communion of the body of Christ without bringing in some form or other, the death of Jesus in our place instead. Let your little ones, then, see the Lord's Supper, and let them be told most clearly what it sets forth. And if not the Lord's Supper, for that is not the thing itself, but only the shadow of the glorious fact, dwell much and often in their presence upon the sufferings and death of our Redeemer. Let them think of Gethsemane and Gabbatha and Golgotha, and let them learn to sing in plaintive tones of him who laid down his life for us. Tell them who it was that suffered and why. And when attention is excited upon the best of themes, let us be ready to explain the great transaction by which God is just, and yet sinners are justified. Children can well understand the doctrine of the expiatory sacrifice. Taking up that last point, if it is argued that the children will not understand what is going on, this is obviously so for very young children. But parents have the privilege of explaining matters to their offspring, and it is in the longer term that the full benefit will be reaped. What is more, if the preaching is too difficult for the children to understand, blame the preacher, not them. For real preaching will be directed to the children without any loss for the adults. Listen to Spurgeon again. "Feed the little children." I begin to feel more and more that it is a mistake to divide the children from the congregation. I believe in special services for children, but I will also have them worship with us. If our preaching does not teach children, it lacks some element which it ought to possess. The kind of preaching which is best of all for grown-up people is that in which children also will take delight. I like to see the congregation made up not all of the young, nor all of the old, not all of the mature, nor all of the inexperienced, but some of all sorts gathered together. If we are teaching children salvation by works, and grown-up people salvation by grace, we are pulling down in the schoolroom what we build up in the church, and that will never do. Feed the children with the same gospel as the grown-up sheep, though not exactly in the same terms. Let your language be appropriate to them, but let it be the same truth. God forbid that we should have our Sunday schools the hotbeds of Arminianism, while our churches are gardens of Calvinism. We shall soon have a division in the camp, if that be so. The same truth for all. And you cannot expect Christ to be with you in feeding your little flocks, unless you feed them where Christ feeds us. Oh, for the good old corn of the kingdom. We want that, and I am persuaded that when the churches get back to the old food again, when the saints get back to the old Puritanic method, then we shall get the church into fellowship with Jesus, and Jesus will do wonders in our midst. These are real, practical issues. Many churches need urgent reform in this area. Too many churches resemble a kindergarten these days, or else the children are removed altogether. The infants of Puritans drank in divinity with their mother's milk, it is said. Likewise the separatists. Spurgeon referred to the old way. The old is better. The members of the Puritan and separatist churches just would not recognize what goes on today. Nor, I suggest, would the members of the New Testament churches. Christian reader, Christian parent, you want to see your children and grandchildren saved, do you not? Of course you do. John, when writing to the elect ladies, said, I rejoice greatly that I have found some of your children walking in truth, as we have received commandment from the Father. He said, when writing to Gaius, I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Well then, Christian parent, if you desire the same joy, there are biblical principles for you to follow. You must obey God's commands and carry out his ordinances. Do not palm off your children's spiritual upbringing onto others, Sunday school teachers and elders. You are responsible. It is your duty. It is more, it is your honor, your joy and privilege to bring up your children in the training and admonition of the Lord. Be a Lois or Eunice to your offspring. Furthermore, it is part of your responsibility as a member of your church to encourage that church to see that its arrangements are conducive to this biblical upbringing of your children. Most definitely, those arrangements must not militate against it. Too often, they do these days. These points are so vital, and they sound so stark and out of place in this generation, a summary is called for. I have said nothing which reflects a lack of love for children. What more could be desired for a child than that he should be saved? All that I have said is with that purpose. We have the revealed pattern of church life, its order and worship in the New Testament, and we must never do anything to militate against it. Children must be in worship. They must hear the preaching and observe the ordinances, otherwise they cannot possibly ask about it. And that is the biblical method of dealing with children, is it not? The New Testament knows nothing whatsoever of any special emphasis upon children's work nor worship by them. They were never segregated by the early church. Preaching must reach the children. It must be directed towards them. The instruction and application must include them. To have a separate address for children during a preaching service is a confession of failure. It's an error of judgment. Preaching which does not meet the needs of the entire congregation is not preaching. God designed preaching to meet the spiritual needs of all men, women, and children, irrespective of age. It must never be forgotten that Sunday schools are a late 18th century innovation. I do not say they are wrong, but they must never assume a place where the New Testament pattern is broken down by an invention of man. Therefore, children must not be in a Sunday school instead of being in the gathering of the church, for instance. No one should be instructing children in a separate meeting when they themselves, as the children, should be sitting under the regular preaching of the gospel. Furthermore, parents must not shuffle off their responsibilities and privileges to others. Christians in the spiritual realm must never act like many pagans do when they have children, immediately handing them over to childminders in order that they can carry on with their giddy lifestyle. While the child must be evangelized, so he must be taught to worship. What is more, the New Testament method of evangelism was not, as very often today, aimed at the child in the hope that the parents might follow. No. Paul looked for the conversion of the parents. The child would then be their responsibility. We must not reverse this order. We must not go for the soft option. It goes without saying that if separate spiritual activities are scripturally unwarranted in the church, there cannot be the slightest justification for meetings to cater for carnal activities and amusements. Yet how very frequently this is a feature of churches nowadays. The aim, the reason, which is commonly trotted out to justify the practice, that is, of doing anything and everything in order to keep the young people, is wrong. To bring this summary to an end, I include a few relevant quotes from other men, men of very different styles and backgrounds. First, Kenneth McRae. At one assembly of the Free Church of Scotland, a certain proposal came up, a proposal to deal with the lapsing of youth. That is, young people were not remaining within the Free Church. The proposal was for organizations to be formed to foster friendship among young people. McRae wrote, I felt called upon to oppose. I gave warning as to the serious consequences of any attempt to introduce any such thing. A few months later, he prepared a report for the assembly, a report of his findings when, in 1936, he was instructed by the assembly to spend some time preaching among churches which had declined, with a view to seeking to persuade the young people of the church to a greater interest in and zeal for the message and testimony which has been given to the Free Church of Scotland to declare. Part of his report dealt with the desperate needs of the young people, and he warned that if the church failed them, their falling away would be inevitable. But that was the very thing which was happening. He went on to say that the great mission of some churches would almost appear to be to amuse their young people. Some time later, he prepared an address on the subject entitled Youth and the Church. He deplored the modern idea, the segregation of youth inside the church so as to keep the youth. It takes many forms. In liberal churches, the provision of guilds, clubs, amusements. In more conservative circles, fellowships, conventions. He highlighted the great breakdown, the decay of vital religion, seen in the preaching, in attendance, in decline of family discipline. The only hope for a restoration was in a return to sound, vital preaching. But this is what this age will not have, he complained. And the idea of the segregation of youth seems to many evangelicals to be the only answer to the problem. Peering into the darkening future, he confessed, we do not know where such an irresponsible movement will ultimately land. That is, what it will lead to. He concluded by saying, nothing can be better than the old biblical system of a former day, which taught that the stated means of grace were for all age groups. My second quotation is another from Spurgeon. When lecturing to his students on attention, he said, to a rational preacher, and all are not rational, it must seem essential to interest all his audience, from the eldest to the youngest. We ought not to make even children inattentive. Make them inattentive, say you? Who does that? I say that most preachers do, and when children are not quiet in a meeting, it is often as much our fault as theirs. Can you not put in a little story or parable on purpose for the little ones? Can you not catch the eye of the boy in the gallery and the little girl downstairs who have begun to fidget and smile them into order? I often talk with my eyes to the orphan boys at the foot of my pulpit. We want all eyes fixed upon us and all ears open to me. To me, it is an annoyance if even a blind man does not look at me with his face. If I see anybody turning round, whispering, nodding, or looking at his watch, I judge I'm not up to the mark, and must by some means win these minds. Very seldom have I to complain, and when I do, my general plan is to complain of myself, and own that I have no right to attention, unless I know how to command it. My last is from Lloyd-Jones. Now, as regards his preaching, as he himself said, according to modern standards, my ideas on preaching are all wrong. He was too long, too difficult, gave too many reasons and arguments in his sermons, put in too much teaching, and so on. New converts should never hear him. Nobody under conviction should go anywhere near him, and all the rest of it. Such, he admitted, was the modern assessment of his preaching. However, when he fell ill and could not preach for a while, he received many letters. He said, the letter I prized was from a little girl aged 12, who wrote on behalf of herself and her brother, unbeknown to their parents, saying that they were praying for my recovery and hoping I would soon be back in the pulpit. She then gave the reason for this, and that is what pleased me so much. She said, because you are the only preacher we can understand. This matter of children in worship is so important I will return to it in a later chapter. I must not trespass on any more space just now, but may I suggest places where further material can be read, excellent material, from what many would consider surprising sources. How is it that men like Spurgeon, Whitfield, McCheyn, Brainerd, Ryle, and others were able to preach to children, and not only to adults? See how Jonathan Edwards addressed the children In his farewell sermon at Northampton, Massachusetts, for instance. Much profit could be gained from reading an article by Ian Murray, Children and the Sermon. Likewise, the matter found in issue 7 of the Banner of Truth, June 1957. Unfortunately, the peace of the ancient church was disrupted not by noisy children, but by the tendency of the members to rebuke and warn each other over the most trivial matters. The separatists have rediscovered the New Testament pattern of church life, or something very close to it, and the sudden and radical enlightenment proved rather a heady concoction for most of them. They have made a giant leap from the state church to an independent church, from magistrates and prelates running everyday church affairs over the heads of the silent masses, to every member active. What they had left behind in the Church of England was abominable for its laxity, certainly. But they now pressed scrutiny of each other to the limit and beyond. Nothing was excluded, and the church was soon rent by scandals and quarrels. The unedifying story was told to the world in a highly biased account by George, the brother of Francis Johnson, entitled A Discourse of Some Troubles and Excommunications in the Banished English Church at Amsterdam. It extended to over 200 pages. Another ex-member published A Discovery of Brownism, a slanderous work and very spiteful. Some others published The Profane Schism of the Brownists or Separatists, an unrestrained attack. It is only fair to record that William Bradford painted a different picture. But it is sad to have to say that the quarrels between the Johnson brothers were severe, and concerned the clothes, jewellery, and hats of Francis's wife, among other things. Some matters were trivial, but on the other hand, some things needed to be discussed. Discipline was required. Some of their strictures would not come amiss in these lax days. For instance, Daniel Studley, the elder already mentioned, was rightly deposed because of immorality. But that all churches made efforts to secure godliness and practical holiness in the daily life of all the members by mutual spiritual discipline. But the worst and saddest dispute of all occurred in 1610. The final disruption was between Francis Johnson and Henry Ainsworth over the practicalities of rule in the church. Johnson emphasized the functions, dignity, and power of the elders, and left no room for the voice of the church members. He really acted as a tyrant, or an inquisitor in the church, and did much harm. He set aside elections, saying that the elders must appoint the teachers, and only the elders can exclude and receive members. He took the line that the elders exercise all church power, the members have none. This issue had been a difficult one for all the separatists right from the start. Henry Barrow had been unable to sort out the question satisfactorily, even though he had once insisted that all the affairs of the church belonged to that body together. The discussion turned on the interpretation of Matthew 18:17, tell it to the church. Does this mean the church members, Congregationalism, or the elders, Presbyterianism? Johnson, who had been a staunch Presbyterian in his younger days, now took a decided stance against the members. In opposition, Ainsworth contended that the ruling power of the church does not lie in pope, priest, elder, or the congregation, but only in Christ. He still agreed that baptism and the Lord's Supper could only be administered by the pastor or teacher, but he asserted that the whole church has the power to discipline. The voice of the members must be heard, he declared. He based his arguments upon the priesthood of all believers. There was no middle way between these two opinions, opinions which could not possibly exist alongside each other within one church, if harmony was to be maintained. The friction between the two men was so great that Ainsworth separated with a large following and began to worship two doors away, whereupon Johnson excommunicated Ainsworth and all with him, with much acrimony. The local authorities were called in, and they decided that the meeting house rightly belonged to Ainsworth. Johnson moved to Emden with his followers in 1613, but was back in Amsterdam in 1617, still calling himself the pastor of the ancient church. He died in January 1618, insisting to the very last that he was in the right in the arguments with the others. After Johnson's death, some of his followers rejoined the church under Ainsworth, while the rest decided to emigrate to America. They braved the terrors of the Atlantic under harrowing conditions. 180 people packed like herrings in an unseaworthy vessel. The captain died during the voyage. The ship drifted aimlessly on the trackless ocean. The food gave out, and dysentery raged among the hapless passengers. At long last, a wretched and pathetic remnant of 50 reached Virginia, where the church was established, in 1619, under an elder called Blackwell. Meanwhile, the church formed by Ainsworth continued for many years after his death. But early in the 18th century, it was united with the Presbyterian Church in Amsterdam and lost its separate identity. Before that, one of its subsequent pastors founded the Broadmead Baptist Church in Bristol. The story of the ancient church is very, very sad in many respects, and is altogether too easy to criticize it. The church had started so well with great enthusiasm and showed immense promise, but it lost its way. The truth is, these early separatists were ardent, earnest, mighty men, and their rediscovery of New Testament principles was strong, heady stuff for them. Furthermore, since the formation of the church was accompanied by savage persecution, they were not reforming the church in theory from the vantage of a comfortable armchair. They were not idle amateurs, languidly dabbling with church reform. They were up to the neck and beyond in the life and death business. This must not be ignored or dismissed. Nevertheless, it is sad to have to say that the combination of events proved too much for the strong-willed men involved. It has to be admitted that the tales of scandal and church offence during these turbulent years do not make pleasant reading, and they compare unfavourably with the work of the Puritan preachers back in England who conformed to the established church. Or do they? It cannot be denied that the separatists made their mistakes. Bad mistakes, yes, they were foolish, and worse, sin was involved. Yet they were struggling to reach out for New Testament church life. This is the point. The easiest way to avoid disputes in the church is doubtless to do as Perkins and many others did, and never deal with the issues of reform. At all events, when independent thinking spiritual men tried to recover New Testament church life, and tried to do it under very difficult conditions, it took a huge amount of grace to do it without falling apart. The pioneer separatists just could not manage it. Even so, they made the attempt, all honour to them. But in any case, we find something similar in the New Testament itself. Paul found it necessary to write to the churches at Rome and Corinth, who faced similar tensions among the members. And undeniably the members of those churches got it wrong from time to time. But if there are no difficulties in a church, then it must be dead. There is no excuse for sin. But in a fallen world, problems are inevitable when a church tries to get as close as it can to the New Testament. A graveyard is a very quiet place. Hence the need for the exhortation to church members, even in the New Testament, to have a walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavouring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Sadly, the early separatists failed miserably in this respect, but they tried, and their work lived on. There were others who would take their place on the battlefront. The struggle for the recovery of the church was proving long and arduous, but the truth was gaining ground all the time. The first separatists, for all their failures, had pressed home another thrust with the sword of the Spirit. They did not suffer and die in vain.